My name is Mazen Kumseya. I'm a professor at Bethlehem University, although I teach very few courses, sometimes one course a year. I'm a full-time volunteer, basically, at the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability here in Bethlehem. This is an institute for sustainable human and natural communities that we started about 10 years ago, and my wife and I are full-time volunteers at it. My background is in biology, biodiversity, and medical genetics, and I worked in universities in the U.S., like Duke and Yale University before coming back to Palestine in 2008. I was born here and raised here. I'm one of 15 million Palestinians. 15 million Palestinians, most of them are displaced. Over 8.5 million of us are refugees or displaced people. And we have been under a colonial system of repression, ethnic cleansing, and genocide since 1948, the foundation of the State of Israel on top of Palestine. So as a result of this colonization, you had the loss of about 250,000 indigenous people who were killed, and about an equivalent amount who were injured and left with disabilities, debilitating injuries like missing eyes and limbs. And as I mentioned, most of us are refugees or displaced people. Over a million of us have been kidnapped and imprisoned by the colonial system, the Israeli regime. And now the focus is on Gaza, of course. I'm not in Gaza, I'm in the West Bank. Situation in Gaza, of course, is where everybody is focused on now. And Gaza Strip is a small strip of land, about 365 square kilometers, with some 2.3 million Palestinians. 70% of them are refugees or displaced people. And those have been kicked out of their homes and lands in 1948. And the Gaza Strip is undergoing active extermination campaign, whereby people are literally being lined up and shot or shot by sniper fire. Children, etc., with head wounds, direct head wounds, intentional killing, intentional bombing of civilian areas. Most of the residential buildings have been demolished, and there are still tens of thousands of people under the rubble, unaccounted for, because we don't know where they are and what's happened to them. So the situation is really horrific in the Gaza Strip. I speak to you from Bethlehem, that's in the West Bank. It's not as bad as Gaza, of course. We have our own ghettos here, the ghetto of Bethlehem, the ghetto of Ramallah, the ghetto of Nablus. These are attacked frequently. Homes are demolished. People are removed from their lands. People are arrested. Sometimes, you know, people are attacked with pogroms from the settlers and the soldiers. Houses burned, cars burned, and even people burned. But still, that's much less than what's happening in the Gaza Strip.
One thing I think would be nice to know for us people in Britain is to what extent the British are blamed by people living in Gaza and the West Bank and Palestinians generally for, obviously, you know, it was the British mandate between World War One and World War Two that handed on Palestine to the current government, the regime, you know, the Zionists.
Right. I mean, the as many problems in the world, whether it's India and Pakistan, or a splitting of Tanzania from Kenya, or any of those things, or the colonial British structures in what became known as Australia that demolished a lot of Aborigines. The British Empire is basically responsible for a lot of calamities around the world, and we are no exception. It started actually in 1845 when the British government hired the services of Lieutenant Colonel George Gawler, who was in charge of colonization in Australia, and they asked him to look about making Jewish colonies in Palestine. And he produced a document about that called Jewish Colonization of Palestine as the Most Sensible Remedy for the Ills of Asiatic Turkey. And the British Empire adopted this in 1845, and they allocated money for it and proceeded, although it didn't pick up steam in the second half of the 19th century. Picked up steam in the first half of the 20th century, as you pointed out with the Balfour Declaration, 1917, where the British government promised to give Jews around the world a place to colonize called Palestine. And so they put in the money in it and then got what's called the UN, not the UN, at the time it was called League of Nations, the League of Nations that British government, with the help of the U.S. government, twisted their arms to approve a mandate of the British government on Palestine that started in 1920. At the time, the British appointed a Zionist Jew by the name of Herbert Samuel to oversee Palestine. He was representative of the Zionist organization in Paris in 1919. So they appointed him in 1920 to oversee Palestine and oversee the implementation of the Balfour Declaration, which basically given by a government that has no rights here, no authorities here, to a non-governmental organization called the World Zionist Organization to give them a piece of land called Palestine that doesn't belong to either of them, either the British Empire or the World Zionist Congress, World Zionist Organization. So, yes, the British indeed are to blame, the governments I'm talking about, historically for 100 years have sponsored, supported, and financed and protected this pet project called Zionism. And this pet project of Zionism that they created, the British created, this pet project is basically to transform a country that's multi-ethnic, multicultural, multi-religious, and multilingual country called Palestine to make it the Jewish state of Israel. And I say multilingual because before 1948, we had 44 languages spoken in Palestine before the State of Israel was created. So I think you can see the culpability here. And it's still culpable because...
Well, yeah, hang on, though, because there's a lot of people now, Jews included, saying that Zionism has got nothing to do with the Judaic religion, you know, the Torah, the Old Testament, that this is a sort of attempt to hijack the faith, rather like, say, groups like ISIS did with Islam.
Indeed, Zionism has as much to do with Judaism as the Crusaders had with Christianity. The Crusaders were done for political purposes in Europe, hijacked Christianity basically to use it as a weapon, as a tool to mobilize and create colonization of Palestine in the 11th and 12th century by creating what's called the Kingdom of God and Kingdom of Jerusalem and so on, European colonies in Palestine, creating a bloodbath of indigenous people of all religions, by the way. So crusaderism, if you want, is a similar phenomena to Zionism. They are both political phenomena that uses religion successfully, I might say, And because religion is obviously emotional and gets people enticed to think that this has somehow to do with God's promised land and protecting the religion and so on. So yes, it's a propaganda, but it's an effective propaganda and has been used in the past by all religions.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that, I mean, for example, here, one of the main streets, if you go down to the city centre here in Bristol, is called Baldwin Street. This is obviously a reference to the kings of Jerusalem in the Crusades, Baldwin.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And people think of some of those people as heroes, as trying, quote unquote, to liberate the holy sites from those infidel Muslims. Now, my family is Christian, by the way. We happen to be Greek Orthodox Christian, which is ancient here before Catholicism and so forth. Mm-hmm. But anyways, the Christians here fought, my ancestors fought with fellow Muslims against the Crusaders, even though we are Christian. Why did we fight against the Crusaders? For the same reason we fight against Zionism. We like diversity. We like the fact that Palestine has always had many religions and many languages and many people. We don't like the idea of somebody coming to us and saying, I want to make it a Catholic country, or I want to make it the Jewish state. It's the same idea, an idea of exclusivism, an idea of chauvinistic, ethnocentric, nationalistic structures that don't produce peace, but produce wars, which we see already happening here.
Well, we certainly do. What about Netanyahu as a figure, though, and as a figurehead for this Zionist, the right-wing bloc, which, I mean, they've basically been brought up to think that that everybody in the region has got to go and they are going to now try and dominate. But for you, as a Palestinian, what do you think it is that's motivating Netanyahu? Because he does, I mean, he does talk a bit about, you know, tries to make reference to the Old Testament, and he uses some religious language, but he seems now to want to open up almost every week a new front to find people to kill in that region. You know, it's amazing to see him really now deciding to pick a fight with the Lebanese too, even though he hasn't really won anything in Gaza. So he hasn't got rid of Hamas. He's just recruited more people to Hamas. He hasn't freed the hostages. He's basically been killing the hostages. So he hasn't fulfilled any of his war aims, but he seems to want to open up more and more fights with the surrounding countries.
Well, let me address what motivates Netanyahu is your question. What motivates him is the same motivation that motivates Christopher Columbus, you know, George Washington, John Smith, the people in South Africa and who colonized South Africa, the people who colonized the South American continent, you know, Mexico, the Spaniards who traveled and butchered people in the Aztecs, or the British leaders and commanders who colonized what became known as Australia, or New Zealand, Aotearoa, or many of those, the same motivation, the same ideas. I don't want to make it personal about Netanyahu. He's one of many, many people who believe the same ideology. In fact, it represents a majority of the colonizer population. Majority of the colonizer population believes the same way. So I think it's understandable from a colonial perspective to have the attitudes of dehumanizing the indigenous people, considering every one of them to be, every one of the indigenous people to be an enemy, and as such, including their children, by the way. Half of Gaza population is children, and Israel is waging a war on the children as a colonizing power, because these are the indigenous people, and this is a way to get rid of indigenous people, is to genocide them using a verb, genocide. So that's what happens. That's what motivates such people. In terms of the immediate, you know, what you allude to, what he promises his people and what he delivers, of course, you can expect colonizers to use the language of, we will defeat the local people, we will fight them until they surrender. And that can happen, of course, by genocide. That will cause people to be finished off so there's nobody left to surrender, basically, as happened with the Aborigine in Australia, or Native American tribes, the Mohawk, or you know, many Cheyenne and other tribes in North America. So it's understandable, their language, their use of language, to convince primarily their own people. These are the leaders of the colonizers, to convince the populace that's benefiting, that's privileged society, the colonizers, that they are on the right track and that they have God on their side. That's why Netanyahu, who's an atheist, who's, by the way, is not his real name. Netanyahu is not his real name. Miliowski is his real name. He's a Polish guy, changed his name. His family came from Poland here, Polish Jews, if you want, Ashkenazis who came here to colonize. His father was a terrorist, an assistant to Jabotinsky, who's an arch terrorist, labeled by the British government even as a terrorist, both Netanyahu's father and Jabotinsky. Netanyahu's father was an assistant to Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was one of the most wanted terrorists in the 1930s, late 1930s, early 1940s by the British government that had a mandate on Palestine.
I interviewed a few years ago, before he died, Bill Nash, who was an army officer for the British Army in the 1940s. He said they had a terrible time with the Jewish terrorists, or as we probably now call them, Zionist terrorists, that many of his friends and colleagues were killed because those Arab people who came forward and started speaking often were just assassinated. And then, of course, there was a massive destruction of the British at the King David Hotel. So I wonder, you know, to what extent was this the idea was a British idea, that it was supposed to be going to work. But then actually what happened was it was a very much more violent handover than the British expected.
Yes, indeed. The history has its nuances. The British, as I said, started by appointing Zionists to rule Palestine under a mandate. That was in 1920-21. Then the British had three indigenous people uprisings against them for their support of Zionism. That included 1921 uprising, 1929 uprising, and 1936 to 1939 uprising. The third one, that 1936 to 1939 Palestinian uprising against the British and against the Zionist project, caused the British government to rethink its policies, because they were actually outside of Europe. They had tied most of their British army in Palestine. They had more here in Palestine, a tiny area. They had more soldiers here than they had in the whole of India at the time, 1936 to 1939. And you know the Indian subcontinent, how large that is. So obviously they were in trouble as a British government dealing with the indigenous people, which caused them to produce what's called the White Paper to try and limit Zionist migration and colonization of Palestine. This was 1939. Also, that was the launch of the World War, as you know. And so they didn't want to have their forces tied up in fighting indigenous people in Palestine, so they tried to make some compromises. These compromises didn't sit well with the Zionist monster that they had created and nurtured between 1917 and 1939, we're talking over 22 years. So this Zionist monster they created, including people like Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky and others who were basically under the wing of the British government, this monster was large enough to say, hey, I can now assert my authority. And the British tried to convince them, okay, you can do that, but do it after the World War. And Ben-Gurion was willing to wait until after the Second World War to declare war on the British for their white paper. But Jabotinsky said, we're not going to wait. So even during the Second World War, Jabotinsky terrorist forces, underground forces, engaged in attacks not only against the indigenous Palestinians, but also against the British occupiers of Palestine.
A couple of times you've mentioned Australia. Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've had King Charles III visiting Australia. And there, he didn't get a very good reception at all, in fact. There was an Aboriginal senator from Victoria called Lydia Thorpe, who said to him, in fact, in front of him, she was heckling him, really. She said, you committed genocide against our people. Give us our land back. Give us back what you stole to us. Our bones, our babies, our people. You destroyed our lands. Give us a treaty. We want a treaty in the country. And then she finished with the words, you are a genocidalist. And I've no doubt that Lydia was pointing also to the British support for the genocide going on now in Gaza. So I wonder, I mean, to what extent can we lay some of these problems at the British royal family's feet? Obviously, they're not people that we choose. It's a bit like Saudi Arabia here. We have a monarchy. We're not allowed to elect the person that makes all the key decisions, appoints our army chiefs, our police chiefs, our cabinet is all appointed by the king. So this British royal family, I wonder what you make of them from a Palestinian perspective and bearing in mind this absolutely disastrous trip there's just been to Australia.
Yes, actually, I was in Australia and New Zealand, Aotearoa, in July, and I met Lydia Thorpe and I met many of these people, and we talked a lot about the Aborigine population in Australia and what happened to them, the genocide that occurred there. And of course, yes, the British government, which of course there was changes in the way of governance from the beginnings of the British colonization in Australia to this day, and the royal family was allowed in the British system to keep its wealth and resources and lands and so on, but to have less political power, which is now vested in an electoral parliamentary system. But nevertheless, the symbolism of it is still there, of course, and still the decisions are Her Royal Family, Her Royal Highness, or His Royal King of the United Kingdom, and not only the United Kingdom, but of course the Commonwealth countries. We have to remember Australia is part of the Commonwealth, so technically, even the Australian flag has a British flag in it and so on. So it's still part of the system of hegemony and colonization that existed before and continues to exist to this day. So I fully approve with what the indigenous people's reaction to the British monarchy's visit to their subcontinent, if you want. And I think there's a lot of blame to go around on the British, I must say. And so the same for Palestine, of course. And so, yes, we share this as people of the global south, the indigenous people who are devastated by Western colonization, not, of course, just the British. I have to remember Germans in Namibia, or the French in Algeria, or the Belgians in the Congo, which committed genocides under King Leopold, etc. And those kings, by the way, they used to marry each other in the royalties of Europe. So Europe as a whole, including the England, UK, has a lot to answer for, which I haven't.
Our king is actually German. Charles' family are Germans, you know. So they even had to change their name, as I'm sure you know. But look, interesting to see, you know, that you've been chatting to Lydia and people like that. And be nice. I mean, obviously, what's going on is a genocide. We've had today at Prime Minister's Questions this week, Keir Starmer saying he doesn't refer to it as genocide, even though he is a trained human rights lawyer. Although his track record on all that is not good. He says it's OK to withhold water and food from people. He seems to think that that's OK when it comes to human rights. He also thinks it's OK to lock up journalists like Julian Assange and to fail to prosecute child abusers and paedophiles such as Jimmy Savile, which is all those are decisions that were made when he was director of public prosecutions here. So I'm afraid our prime minister is not the most reliable human rights lawyer in the world. But let me just turn to some news.
I was going to say the least they could do is investigate and punish those who killed British citizens here in Palestine, UK citizens like Tom Herndell, for example. Tom Herndell was a British citizen who came here to Palestine, was trying to help a child crossing the street when there's, you know, attacks by the soldiers. And he tried to pick up a child and he was shot in the head. And the killer is still at loose because he's an Israeli soldier and Israel is above the law, above international law and above British law and above any laws.
This is another aspect of it you brought up there. Fascinating, in fact, that you've got soldiers. You don't seem to have police. You seem to have soldiers doing the policing. And also, many of the Israeli soldiers seem to prefer shooting and killing women and children, journalists and medical workers, rather than other soldiers.
Yes, absolutely. We have a colonial system. I hate to use the word soldiers, even that is not a good, they are colonial armed thugs, basically. The Israeli army, as they call themselves, the Israeli army, is actually the largest terrorist organization in the world today, killing civilians every day.
I've been reading some articles from Israeli websites talking about the Lubavitch movement, and I don't really know much about them, although I do know that one of the Lubavitchers, they call them, these are rabbis who are particularly right wing, and they seem to think that, well, they have their interpretation of the Torah, which is the Talmud. And a lot of people would disagree with it. But apparently back in the 12th century, there was a rabbi called Maimonides over in Egypt. And he wrote a book called The Law of Kings, where he said the Messianic king will arise in the future and restore the Davidic kingdom to its former state and original sovereignty. He will rebuild the temple and gather the dispersed of Israel. All the laws will be reinstituted in his days, as they had been aforetimes. Sacrifices will again be offered, and the sabbatical years and jubilee years will be observed fully as ordained by the Torah. So what is being written about in these couple of articles I've read now over the last eight months or so is that Netanyahu actually believes that he's got to create the right conditions for the coming of the Jewish Messiah. Now, obviously, the Jews actually don't accept Jesus as the Messiah, but they've got to have a Messiah sometime, haven't they, Mazin?
Well, my readings of the Jewish Torah and the Talmud, you know, very briefly, because we don't have too much time to talk about this in detail, but very briefly, a religious Jew cannot be a Zionist unless they believe the Messiah has already came. This is per the Torah. The Torah says, God dispersed you in the lands because you disobeyed his commands, and only when the Messiah comes, only when the Messiah comes, you will be allowed to return to the land from which you were dispersed. This is in the Torah, very clear instructions. That is why when Herzl came up with the idea, well, not came up with the idea, because as I said, the idea is a British idea from 1845, but when Herzl formulated it in a very good book called The Jewish State, the Judenstaat, he's German, of course, speaking person, in 1897, and hosted the first World Zionist Congress, or World Zionist Organization, was formed in 1897. Herzl was an atheist, not a religious person. He had very difficult time convincing religious Jews, because religious Jews, as I said, they obey the Torah. The Torah says only when the Messiah comes you can go back to the land. That's it. So religious Jews, by definition, should not, would not support Zionism. Ben-Gurion had a difficulty convincing any religious Jews really to join his movement. Only in the second half of the 20th century, really, is when more Orthodox religious Jews were convinced to join the movement of Zionism, because, you know, they saw some benefit from it, and Ben-Gurion was smart enough to offer them finances and other benefits, for example, that they can keep studying the Torah, you know, and they will be paid salary, and they don't have to serve in the Israeli army, because that's against the Torah, because they shouldn't recognize the State of Israel. So most of the Jews in the 1950s who are religious were anti-Zionist. This is now half and half, you know, half the religious Orthodox Jews support Zionism and half...
So are you talking about in Israel or around the world?
Both. So, yeah.
So we don't hear much from the anti-Zionist Orthodox Jews, do we?
Now, that's a good point that you make. Why don't we hear enough about them? It's because the media in the Western world is managed and controlled by the Zionists, and they're not allow you to hear about Jewish opposition to Zionists, whether secular opposition, intellectual opposition, or religious opposition, because that will undermine the Zionist idea.
Yeah, well, we don't hear much about how Russians are human beings too, either, in the Western press these days. Listen, look, just to wind up, can you give us an idea of what life is like now in the West Bank? I think we know it's absolute horror show going on in Gaza, particularly with the in northern Gaza, where many people are being simply shot by soldiers for just simply for being there, ordinary people now. And also the aid has been prevented from getting in for about 3 weeks or so. But what about in the West Bank? How are things there?
Well, in the West Bank, since October 7, 2023, so we're talking about 1 year and whatever, the change has been dramatic. In this past year, unemployment in the West Bank went up from about 20-some percent to now about 45%. In places like Bethlehem, it's worse because we're a tourist town. We used to get a lot of Christian tourists coming to the Church of Nativity. So people here are economically in bad shape. Also, Israel prevented Palestinian workers from working within the Green Line or in the Israeli settlements even. So the economy is horrific. And also since day one, since October 7, 2023, Israel blockaded our ghettos, our concentration camps. The Gaza Strip was a concentration camp before, of course, and it still is, but now it's being divided into three concentration camps, North Gaza, Middle Gaza, and South Gaza. But in the West Bank, there were at least 12 concentration camps for us. Bethlehem was one of them. But these concentration camps or people warehouses or bantustans or whatever you want to call them, they are places to store the unwanted indigenous people. Like Bethlehem, for example, is a place to store 270,000 Palestinians in a very small area, very crowded area. Those crowded areas, archipelago of islands, basically, in the West Bank, were disconnected from each other, although we were able to travel between them before October 2023. Now, the blockade on them has increased, and it has become very, very difficult to move between one place or another. So I could go on, of course, on the attacks. Israeli army comes into our towns and villages and refugee camps, arresting people, kidnapping people, I should say, not arresting, because that implies some sort of legality. They're kidnapping civilians, and they are torturing them in jail, and people are being killed in jail even. So far, over 50 people. 1 minute.
What about the basics, like, I mean, simply going out, I don't know, maybe buying milk and food, this sort of thing? Do you have cafes open, that kind of thing, around where you are?
Well, the Bethlehem area, as I mentioned, was devastated because we are a tourist town, so most hotels, many restaurants are closed. Essentially, all hotels are closed, actually. And many of the, or most of the restaurants have suffered significantly. And the lack of economy, of course, doesn't allow people to have ability to go to restaurants because they don't have income. So a lot of people are unemployed. A lot of people are hungry. So they have to rely on some charity and things like that. But, you know, as you said earlier, and as I said also, that Gaza is certainly much, much worse. So we still feel a little more blessed than Gaza. Now the war is spreading into Lebanon, and it's coming to the West Bank. I'm sure it's already started in the north, in Nablus and Jenin and Tulkarem, where the Israeli army is destroying infrastructure, destroying houses, destroying water and sewage systems. So it's coming to the West Bank as it's coming to Lebanon, because Israel is not a project about Palestine. Israel is a Zionist project about controlling the whole Middle East from the Euphrates to the Nile. And that's what their original intent is. And now it's being executed.
Any plucky listeners were determined to get the right visas and this sort of thing and come and visit Bethlehem this Christmas. Is it possible?
Yes, you are welcome to come. Bethlehem is probably safer than most other cities in Palestine, most other areas in Palestine. So we welcome visitors. We have international visitors. I have this International Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability that I volunteer at, and we welcome international volunteers. There are even some here already. There are internationals who come to help us. We welcome them. We'll keep you away from going to conflict areas. You will stay in Bethlehem itself as a city, and it's fairly safe.
Well, I'm surprised. I suppose I've travelled extensively around the world, and I've noticed that quite often where the Foreign Office tell us this is far too dangerous, don't travel here, actually there's something quite interesting going on, and it sounds similar there. there in Bethlehem. So if people are interested in coming, are there groups like your own? Maybe you can mention some others which can help them get there.
Yes, we can help people get around, and we know where areas that are safe and areas that are not safe are. And we can help people who are here to travel freely, like visit, obviously, Jerusalem, Jericho, Jordan Valley, beautiful areas. We have good sceneries, good whatever. So they can come here, and this is the best time to come because Palestinians feel isolated, feel neglected by the world. As you know, there's International Court of Justice. Now has a case pending for genocide against Israel. International Criminal Court, same thing about Netanyahu and Gallant, for as war criminals and those who engaged in crimes against humanity. So I think it's important. So come visit us. Check our website, palestinenature.org. Thank you.
I wondered if people, because I get an email from you quite regularly. If people want to jump on your email address, what's the best way to do that, Mazim?
Yeah, you can just email me at info@palestinenature.org and I'll put you on our email list.
Okay, Mazim Kunzieh, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.